If this is your first time in our class, or if you've not been here in a while, we're studying the book of Exodus. We've made our way all the way to chapter 7. But we're going to begin this morning with an opening scripture reading from the fourth chapter of the book of Acts. I'll be reading verses 23 through 28, then we'll move into Exodus. Acts 4, verse 23, when they had been released, they refers to Peter and John. They had been released from jail. They went to their own companions and reported all that the chief priests and elders had said to them. And when they heard this, they lifted up their voices to God with one accord and said, O Lord, it is you who have made heaven and earth and sea and all that's in them, who by the Holy Spirit, through the mouth of our father David, your servant, said, Why did the Gentiles rage and the peoples devise futile things? The kings of the earth took their stand, and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his Christ. For truly in this city there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel, to do whatever your hand and your purpose predestined to occur. Acts 4 begins the persecution of the early church. Peter and John were walking near the temple, and they were in a dispute with some of the religious elite over the healing of a lame man. This gave rise to a sermon in which Peter accused both Israel and the Gentiles of putting Jesus to death, even though it was to him that the promises of the Abrahamic covenant had pointed. In his sermon, Peter calls attention to the futility of the Gentile nations that rage against God and against his Messiah. Peter specifically cites the actions of Herod and Pontius Pilate as examples of rulers who, though working through their own volition, were actually fulfilling the decretive will of God, which Peter defines as that which your hand and your purpose predestined to occur. I read this passage because what's true of Pilate and Herod is also true of Pharaoh. The Exodus and the plagues did not happen in a vacuum. There was a divine purpose behind everything that God did in Egypt, and there was a reason that God chose to do what he did specifically the way he did it. Regarding God's divine purpose, God is not reactionary. God does not sit back and wait to see what a man will do and then respond based on the action that that man chose to take. God is not reactionary, he is proactive. God has a plan that was put in place by him to be fulfilled in his time according to his discretion. It's the fact that God has a plan that makes prophecy possible. If you think about it, without a plan, prophecy at best would be a good guess. Prophecy is possible because it is nothing more than the declaration of what God has already chosen in terms of the plan that he's put forth. So what God is doing in Egypt, you'll recall, was prophesied back in the 15th chapter of Genesis. And the fact that it was prophesied is an indication that it was planned. The plan was basically this, that Jacob and a family of 70 persons would incubate in the womb of Egypt. They would grow there into the great nation that God had promised to Abraham, and then God would deliver this great nation by a mighty act which was self-revelatory, meaning that it would be through Israel and through what God would do through the Exodus that Israel and the Gentile world would come to understand that Yahweh is a God who fights for his people and who judges those who oppose him. By the mighty act of the Exodus, we see a mighty act of redemption and an act of judgment. God's person and his character is revealed in a fuller way to those who believe in him for their salvation, as well as to those who are the recipients of his wrath. Now, God chose to deal with Egypt in the specific manner that he did, because it was his plan to judge Egypt and to take apart and unravel Egyptian culture piece by piece. We just in a moment of review, we talked about this in some detail a few weeks ago. God's judgment on Egypt begins with an attack on the gods of Egypt. As we move through the plague narratives, we're going to see that everything God does is designed to discredit, if not to ridicule, the gods of Egypt. Many of the plagues will involve natural phenomena such as insects or hail or darkness, things that have counterparts within the pantheon of Egypt, within the grouping of Egyptian gods. Remember, the only way an Egyptian god can communicate with its subject is through nature, because the Egyptian gods were personification of natural forces. It was the personification of the wind or the Nile or of darkness or of light. So when God, by these plagues, demonstrates his power through this mighty act against Egypt, he's going to be controlling the natural forces. He's going to be controlling nature. And when God controls nature, de facto, he controls the gods of Egypt. But the gods of Egypt are not going to be the only target of the plagues. He's also targeting the religious professional infrastructure in Egypt. The class of professional religious leaders in Egypt were made up of priests. They were made up of actually several different categories of priests. They were made up of sorcerers, of what they call wise men, and sometimes these are also called magicians. So the influence of this great power base in Egypt is hard for us to imagine today. I guess the Vatican is about the closest thing that I could describe to you today. If you've ever been to the Vatican, it's really sort of overwhelming. If you've been through the Vatican Museum, they could, if they really wanted to feed the world, they could sell about 5% of the artifacts that are there and probably feed everyone in the world for no telling how long. It's a very powerful organization when you stand there and you see this. This was the same in Egypt, and this was displayed throughout the land of Egypt by the great temple complexes such as the Temple of Karnak at Thebes, and it was obvious for everyone to see. So when Aaron performs this miracle that we're going to read about in just a moment, what we're going to find there is that Pharaoh is going to appeal to this religious infrastructure, to the priests, to the sorcerers, and to the wise men of Egypt to try to counter the miracles that were done by Moses and Aaron. We're going to see that these men, these sorcerers, were actually able to perform certain wondrous acts, certain enchantments. But as we go through the plague narratives, you're going to see that every time they're able to accomplish something, it's still going to fall short. It's going to be less than effective, and it's not going to work. So the plagues are attacking the gods of Egypt. They're attacking the religious infrastructure of Egypt. They also are going to be a direct challenge on the king himself. Now, the thing to remember about a king in Egypt is that the most important function that he has is maintaining the status quo. There was this thing called Mot. It's an Egyptian term that's typically translated truth, but what it really means is status quo or normalcy. It involves such things as the regular flooding of the Nile, which made agriculture possible in Egypt. It meant things like the cycle of the sun that rises and sets every day. All the things in Egypt that are supposed to happen every day, ultimately it was the king who was responsible for making sure that these functions happen. And yet, it's going to be God who brings disorder to Egypt. And when he brings the plagues on the nation, since the politics and the religion of Egypt coalesce in the person of the king, when God brings disorder to Egypt, he's going to be attacking the king at his single greatest point of vulnerability, his ability to maintain order and status quo in the land. Now let's turn, if you will, we'll begin our exegesis of the text to the 7th chapter of Exodus. We'll read today chapter 7, verses 8 through 13. Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "When Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, 'Work a miracle,' then you shall say to Aaron, 'Take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh, that it may become a serpent.' So Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh, and thus they did just as the Lord had commanded. And Aaron threw his staff down before Pharaoh and his servants, and it became a serpent. Then Pharaoh also called for the wise men and the sorcerers. They also, the magicians of Egypt, did the same thing with their secret arts. For each one threw down his staff, and they turned into serpents. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs. Yet Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them as the Lord had said. This story raises the question or the issue of the satanic counterfeit. We see something in the story, in the first verses of the story, actually, that are going to surprise us. God has given a supernatural sign to Moses and Aaron that they can do before Pharaoh, presumably to convince Pharaoh to let the Israelites leave the land. And after Aaron casts down his staff and it turns into a serpent, Pharaoh calls for his religious elite, the sorcerers and the magicians. The text tells us that they performed the same miracle. How is this possible? How did they do it? The answer pertains to the role of magic in the religion of Egypt. Can we agree that it's not in the DNA of human beings to actually be able to perform a miracle? Do you know a human being who can actually perform a miracle of his own abilities? I don't. To perform a miracle, a human being has to appeal to a greater power than himself. So in each case, in the case of what Aaron does, and in the case of what the Egyptian sorcerers do, there is an appeal to a supernatural power in each case. Behind the miracle done by Moses and Aaron is Yahweh. It was Yahweh who gave the sign to them. So we know that it is Yahweh who performs the miracle. But the power behind the sorcerers of Egypt is none other than Satan. Well, how do we know this? Well, it's pretty clear from what Paul says over in 2 Timothy chapter 3. Just let me read that to you. You don't need to turn. Chapter 3, verses 8 and 9. Paul writes, just as Jannes and Jambres. Now, isn't that interesting? We find out in the New Testament the names of the sorcerers. They're not given to us in the book of Exodus. There's a great deal of extra-biblical literature, Greek literature, and some Hebrew literature, and a lot of the rabbinical writings that name these two gentlemen, Jannes and Jambres. Paul would have obviously known these materials. He would have been familiar with their names, and under the guidance of the Holy Spirit and inspiration, he writes them into the text of 2 Timothy so we know who the names of these people were. Now, whether there were two of them or whether these stood as heads of certain sects within the Egyptian priesthood, we don't know that. But Paul begins by saying, just as Jannes and Jambres opposed Moses, so these men, by these men, he's referring to men contemporary to Paul who were teaching apostasy. Just as Jannes and Jambres opposed Moses, so these men also oppose the truth, men of depraved mind, rejected in regard to the faith. But they will not make further progress, for their folly will be obvious to all, just as Jannes and Jambres' folly was also. So we look at this, and Paul is associating those apostates of his period with the sorcerers who opposed Moses, and he says with regard to all those, these are men who oppose the truth and are rejected with regard to the faith. That's pretty clear evidence where the source of their power came from. It did not come from God. The fact is that Satan was able to empower these sorcerers to perform what I believe was a legitimate miracle. Now, if that surprises you, that they would be able to do this, it shouldn't. Because in the context of the Antichrist, Paul writes to the Thessalonians in his second letter to the Thessalonians. Listen to what he says in chapter 2 of that book. He says, do you not remember that while I was still with you, I was telling you these things? And you know what restrains him now? That's the Antichrist. You know, something is restraining him. so that in his time he'll be revealed. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he's taken out of the way. Then lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. That is, the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with power and signs and miracles. Here Paul says that if you want to think about evil, you have to understand that it would be a lot worse if there were not a restrainer holding him back. The restrainer that Paul refers to here is the Holy Spirit. In fact, he says in verse 7, the spirit of lawlessness is already at work. In other words, if God were not restraining Satan in our day, now, we would see people performing signs and miracles and what the Bible calls lying wonders, just as we see and read about in the 7th chapter of Exodus. So, if that's what we can expect at the end of the church age, why should we be surprised that in this context, before this great act of the Exodus, God loosed Satan sufficiently to allow him to empower these men to perform miracles? Now, important to understand something about Satan's strategy in the world. I've written up here five things that I think are important. The first is, it's Satan's strategy to deceive the elect so that they ignore biblical truth. Jesus alludes to this in the 24th chapter of Matthew when he says that false prophets will arise. They'll be performing great signs and wonders that are so amazing that if it were possible, they would deceive even the elect. Satan's strategy is to provide a false substitute to replace biblical truth. If you're going to take away biblical doctrine and biblical theology and biblical truth, you have to be able to substitute something in its place. And he's happy to do that. He provides a false substitute to replace biblical truth. Paul talks about this in the 4th chapter of 1 Timothy. He says, those who fall away from the faith will be following deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons. It's Satan's strategy to hinder believers from doing God's will. In 2 Peter 2, Peter writes that false prophets and false teachers will introduce heresies that deny Christ. The teaching will probably sound a lot like the gospel. Yet somewhere in it, there will be a denial of who Christ is, or there will be a denial of what Christ did. This false teaching is called doctrine of demons and heresies. Satan's strategy doesn't end with the individual. It's also Satan's strategy to deceive the nations. We read in the 20th chapter of Revelation that before the campaign of Armageddon begins, Satan will come forth to deceive the nations. Let me tell you, he's already doing it, but it's going to get worse. Finally, it is Satan's strategy to blind unbelievers to the gospel. 2 Corinthians 4, Paul talks about the God of this world who's blinded the eyes of unbelievers to the light of the gospel. The world will always prefer humanism to the gospel. So Satan has this arsenal of weapons that he's glad to use against us. But his weapon of choice is deception. Satan's trump card is his ability to counterfeit the truth. How does he do this? Well, he uses false teachers. He uses people who will pervert the understanding of Scripture. They'll teach what Paul calls another gospel, which he calls, again, with regard to Timothy, the doctrine of demons. Satan will offer a counterfeit righteousness. If you're going to take away the imputed righteousness of the gospel, you're going to have to come up with another righteousness. And he does this. Jesus knew about it because he talked about this with the religious elite in his day. He said, this righteousness that you put forth is like a whitewashed tomb. Looks really good on the outside, but on the inside, it's full of hypocrisy, full of lawlessness. Matthew 23. Satan often counterfeits spiritual gifts. I think it's obvious that he does this. You can see it today in the modern charismatic movement. And it does so to the extent that it deceives believers and unbelievers alike. and as a common tool to put forth his agenda and to convince people of his power and of his legitimacy. There are people who have used signs, miracles, and what the Bible calls lying wonders in 2 Thess 2. So that's how I want to frame what happened in Egypt. This event in Egypt ought to be seen for what it was. It was God who lifted his restraint sufficiently to allow these Egyptian sorcerers to perform signs and lying wonders through what the Bible calls their secret arts. They were sufficient to deceive Pharaoh. They were legitimate miracles, but they were counterfeit. They were counterfeit because they led men to the wrong conclusions. It wasn't the miracle itself that was counterfeit. It was the fact that the miracle led people to the wrong conclusion. Let's look quickly again at verses 8 and 9. Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "When Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, 'Work a miracle,' then you shall say to Aaron, 'Take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh, that it may become a serpent.'" Moses and Aaron can't really go back in front of Pharaoh with the same demand that they've just made that he's already rejected. They need to be able to take something new when they go. What Moses and Aaron lack from Pharaoh's perspective is credibility. And that's the purpose of the first sign that God has given to them. Remember, if you weren't here earlier, the first sign is this ability to cast down the rod and have it turn into a serpent. That's what I mean today when I refer to the first sign. Apparently, it was not uncommon for the king of Egypt, because Egypt was bathed in the occult. It was not uncommon for the king of Egypt to demand from those who came and made demands of him that they validate their credibility by performing a miracle. Yahweh anticipates, or perhaps a better word would be knows, that this is what's going to happen. So he tells Moses to be prepared to perform the first sign, the sign of the covenant. Now, there's an interesting change in the Hebrew vocabulary at this point. The common word for snake in Hebrew is nahash. That's the word that was used in all of the previous references to this miracle. If you look back in the Hebrew text of Exodus 3 or Exodus 7:15, the word that's used there is nahash, and that's just the common Hebrew word for snake or serpent. In this case, if you look right below that, the word that is used in this chapter 7, verses 8 through 13, is tanin. They changed the word. Now, I have no doubt that what these two words referred to was the same thing. But there's a slightly different nuance to tanin that makes it quite interesting in this context and perhaps even significant. If you go back in Genesis to the creation story, chapter 1, specifically verse 21. That's the verse that says, "And God created the great sea monsters and all else that moves." Remember that verse in Genesis chapter 1? The word that in the King James is translated whales, in the NIV is translated great creatures of the sea, and the term that's translated in my NASB Bible, great sea monsters, is tanin. Isn't that interesting? There's a symbolism here that we find in the creation story that may transfer over into this story that we're studying now in Exodus chapter 7. It's long been thought that the use of the term tanin in Genesis 1 was a way of making a cryptic reference to something that all of the surrounding cultures around Israel believed. And that is that, here's kind of how the creation stories go with Israel's neighbors. The first thing you have is chaos. Isn't that interesting? It's not that uncommon. It's not that different from Genesis 1:2, where we read that the earth was without form and void. Tohu wabohu means chaos. So all of these cultures saw the world before creation as just being a chaotic mess. And they symbolized this in what they called the primordial waters. It was like the whole world was covered with water. The seas were roaring. The waves were crashing. And in all of the creation stories in the ancient Near East, there is a battle that goes on between the personifications of this chaos with the Creator. There's a battle. You never quite know who's going to win till the end of the battle. So in these surrounding cultures, they would have appealed to Leviathan or Rahab or the great dragon. And they would have seen this as one of the creatures representing chaos that fights against order. So in Genesis 1, guess what Moses does? He says, oh, by the way, just kind of in passing, God created the Tanin. He didn't go fight them. There was never a question about what was going to happen. He created them. You can forget about them. Now, the Bible is not borrowing this information from the surrounding cultures at all. What we have in Genesis is what's known as a polemic. A polemic is a written or verbal attack at an opposing idea. So what you have there in Genesis is when the biblical writer refers to these mythological creatures, Leviathan, the Tanin, Rahab the dragon, he's referring to them as mythological creatures, and he's associating them with the whole mythology that surrounds them, that all of the pagan nations believe. And he's saying, you know what? In the Bible, it's God who created the Tanin. Bruce Waukee and Ron Allen are both evangelical scholars who hold this view, and they're careful to point out that when the Bible uses terms like this, it's not because the biblical writers believe that these creatures existed. Instead, these references refer to this anti-creation chaos, which the surrounding cultures personified as dragons and monsters and snakes. Now remember, Pharaoh's responsible for maintaining order. When Moses uses this term, when he writes this account, and he says the staff was turned not into a Nahash, but to a Tanin, it's a little poke at Pharaoh. He may be alluding to this pending disorder, this chaos, which is going to come on the nation of Egypt, for which Pharaoh is responsible. Verses 10 and 12. So Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh, and they did just as the Lord had commanded. Aaron threw his staff down before Pharaoh and his servants, and it became a serpent, a Tanin. Then Pharaoh also called for the wise men and the sorcerers, and they also did the same thing. And they used their secret arts. For each one threw down his staff, and they turned into serpents. So Moses and Aaron obey. They do what God's told them. And I'm sure when they did, they hoped that Pharaoh would be convinced to do the right thing, that he would view them as legitimate. Cast down Moses' staff, and God transformed it into a serpent. Well, why a serpent? We already know something here, that there may be something going on with the term Tanin, but there's something else as well. As we go through Exodus, we're going to see how the acts that God performs, every one of them attacks some element of Egyptian religion or culture. In this case, the snake, which I have no doubt was a cobra, was a symbol of a particular Egyptian goddess. We talked about this in some detail. Her name was Wadjet. She was the patron goddess of Lower Egypt. That's the north. Guess what's located in Lower Egypt? The land of Goshen, where the Israelites are being held captive. Here's what I think is happening. Moses is standing in front of the Pharaoh, and he has on the Nemes crown. The Nemes crown is a particular crown in Egypt that has at the very front of it a rearing cobra. When he wore that crown, he was declaring himself to be the supreme authority over the land of Goshen. He's wearing it. I could be wrong, but I don't think so. I think he's wearing the crown. He's making a declaration to Moses, I have sovereign authority over the land where your people live. So what does Moses do? Well, God has chosen a particular sign. He obeys, and God turns the staff into a cobra right in front of the king. In choosing to turn the staff into a cobra, he's declaring to Pharaoh that God alone is sovereign authority over the land of Goshen, not you. But when we get to verse 11, something we don't expect to happen happens. Pharaoh calls for his sorcerers, and they duplicate the miracle. The text says that the magicians did the same thing by their secret arts. People have tried to come up with all sorts of crazy explanations for how this happened. Everything from sleight of hand to trickery to being able to I read one commentary where they said they hypnotized the snakes. And Moses starts with a staff that God turns into a living serpent. They started out with a hypnotized snake, which if they held it on the fourth vertebrae down there, it would be stiff like a rod, and then you could put it down and it would wiggle around, and then they could pick it. That's crazy. This is a satanic counterfeit. This is a legitimate miracle. So who's sovereign over Goshen? Is it Yahweh or is it Pharaoh? Well, when we get to verse 12, the demonstration of this first sign before Pharaoh officially begins the battle between Yahweh and the Egyptian king and his priests. And it gives us a snapshot of the drama that's going to come forth. It actually foreshadows some things that we'll see are quite interesting. The participants, these magicians, these men, these sorcerers, the wise men, they perform an act. They're bound together by these secret arts. So we know from verse 11 that the verse says that they were rooted in the occult because it says they did so by their secret arts. The word that's translated secret arts comes from this word L-U-T, loot. It means to wrap or hide. So by extension, it came to mean something that's secret. We even use a term today that sort of captures that. We'll say something is wrapped in secrecy. It's the same concept. These were secret chants and formulas and verses, various things like this that they could perform to do these miracles. Magic was extremely significant in the Egyptian religious cult, and it was one of the ways that the priesthood held power over the people. Well, I think it bears us, it's a good time to ask the question, what is the fundamental issue with magic? Why is the Bible so opposed to it? It's a good question. The fact is that even though God has as one of his attributes immanence means that God is present in and active in the universe that he created. He is presently active in the world. Even though he is, God has created the world. He chose to do this. He chose to create the world with certain inherent laws, and the universe operates, typically speaking, within the context of these laws. Let me give you an example. Water flows downhill because of something we call gravity. If water were to flow uphill without some external cause, like a wind or a pump or something that acts on it, if water were to run uphill, you would be observing behavior that's outside of the normal realm of natural causation. Water doesn't run uphill of its own accord in the world as God created the world. I'll give you another example. It's been my experience that if I am in the room with a knife for even a short period of time, I will cut myself with it. I love knives. But Linda will tell you that time after time after time after time, within 4 or 5 minutes of getting a new knife, I'll be going back looking for the alcohol and a Band-Aid. Now, the fact that I frequently have accidents with knives is not a natural law. It's unbridled stupidity with an inability to learn. I'll admit that, but it is not a natural law. But I've come to know something from my experience with knife cuts. If the cut isn't too serious, usually within about 5 days, your finger will heal. usually takes about 5 days. Now, just think about this a minute. If you cut your finger with a knife, you know that for about 5 days you're going to have to wear a Band-Aid and it's going to hurt a little bit and you need to make sure you don't bump it on something. But in 5 or 6 days, your thumb or finger will be well. You don't really have to pray, do you, that your finger will heal itself? If you had to pray that your finger would heal itself, only believers' fingers would heal. This is part of the what God has built into the universe. He's built in laws and ways that things work. He's built it in. It is the natural way the universe works. This innate ability of the body to heal itself is not a miracle because it's not happening outside of the realm of natural causation. It is what God has put into the universe as part of creation. And it's something that applies to everyone. And here's the principle that we need to consider. God, because He is the creator and the sustainer of the universe, has the sole right to cause the universe to deviate from its normal operation under what we call the laws of nature. Does that make sense? God's the creator. He set things in place to operate a certain way. He has the sole right to sustain it. He has the sole right to cause the universe to deviate. But the sorcerers of Egypt do not have that right. Now, I emphasize this because the correct way to refer to what happened with this miracle is not the staff turned into a snake, but God transformed the inanimate object into a living serpent. So what's the problem? Well, the problem occurs when man, the creature, attempts to perform an act that's outside the natural order, something that's reserved for God and God alone, something that is a right of creatorship. And here's what that man will discover. He'll discover that he can't do it. But if he persists, he may find that there's a power that can. At least within the limits that God has set and is determined to allow. And that power is satanic, it's demonic, and it operates in the realm that we call the occult. So here's the issue with the Egyptian sorcerers. They're tapping into the occult in order to do what is reserved for God alone. And we've already discussed already this concept of satanic counterfeit, and that's how we should interpret what happens in Exodus 7. It was not sleight of hand. It was not trickery. It was a miracle that occurred outside of the natural order. Rods, staffs do not become snakes in the natural order of things. So in the case of these Egyptians, the miracle is associated with the occult, and that's the issue. I want you to remember back, I've said earlier that there clearly was an intent to show the difference between the miracle performed through Moses and Aaron by God and the enchantments of the magicians. The difference is not the miracle itself. The difference is what happens next. Aaron's staff, I'm sure in its form as a serpent, swallows the staff, probably still in the form of a serpent, of the Egyptians. It's intended to demonstrate that the power God allowed Satan to exercise through these sorcerers is limited and it's insufficient. And there are some obvious and not so obvious intimations of this. The most obvious indication is the fact that the Egyptian serpents are devoured. The less obvious indication is found in the Hebrew vocabulary. I know that shocks you. The word swallow, interesting Hebrew word. It's this word, bala. It's used here in Exodus 7, and it's also used in Exodus 15:12, where the sea will swallow the Egyptian army. The final demise of the might of Egypt, which we'll see in chapter 15, is foreshadowed in Exodus chapter 7, verse 12. Satan may have certain leeway to perform a miracle to deceive Pharaoh and his cabinet. But he'll be shown to be limited and insufficient when the sea swallows the Egyptian army. And for anyone who has eyes to see, the fate of Egypt was demonstrated before the face of Pharaoh, before the first plague was ever given. The outcome of what's going to happen is never in dispute. And Moses demonstrated it to Pharaoh, but he was blind and he didn't see it. The theological significance of this sign, this miracle, is that God alone has the right to manipulate nature. The fact doesn't just pertain to the sign. The fact that God is the only one with the right to manipulate nature will be seen throughout the entire plague narratives. And you know, I was sitting there thinking in Andy's sermon when he started talking about Jericho. The people of Jericho knew who Yahweh was, didn't they? And what did they think about him? That he was some esoteric No, they think of God as someone who's fighting for Israel and who's been defeating their enemies and who's about to come in and destroy them. The whole idea of Yahweh's name being revealed in the sense in which it was earlier in Exodus was that we were going to learn some new attributes about God. That he's not just a God who makes covenants with people, he's a God who fights for his people and he judges those who oppose him. God's battle plan for Egypt is built around his right and ability to control his own creation, to control nature. Remember when we first started in this book in the first and second chapter, and I pointed out to you all the creation language that was there, and we talked about it in the context of that creation language linking the book of Exodus back to the book of Genesis. Well, there was a second reason for that. It was preparing us for what's about to come, because everything that happens in these plague narratives is about God controlling his creation. The significance here is really underscored when you think about the nature of the Egyptian gods, that they are personifications of nature, and yet it was Yahweh who created nature and who rules over it. In fact, according to John 1:3, it was Jesus Christ who was the instrument of God in the creation of the world. And it's he who sustains it. When we come to verse 13, Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he didn't listen to them as the Lord had said. We've come to this phrase again, Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and it differs a little bit from the more direct statements we've seen about this earlier in the book. We've been seeing the statements that say, God hardened Pharaoh's heart. This, I believe, is the first occurrence of the phrase in this form where it says his heart was hardened. It may have occurred one other time. The meaning's not any different. Pharaoh is an unrepentant sinner with a pattern of disobedience, even in the face of evidence. In eight of the occurrences of hazak, which is the word that's used here for harden, in eight of the references, and there are 12 such references between Exodus 4 and Exodus 14, in eight of them, it's God who's the subject and the actor. The other four, and this is one of the four, presents the verb as a stative verb. That is, it's a verb that's describing the state of something, not the action that got the object to that state. It's communicating a state of being. But it doesn't change what we've said so far, that ultimately it is God's decree that's behind the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. So what can we learn from this? Well, I think the most important lesson from these verses in Exodus 7 is that counterfeit power is real power, but it's not lasting power, and it's not sufficient power, but it's real. We need to know that because we shouldn't allow ourselves to be deceived by it. It's so easy to be carried away by false doctrine. False doctrine doesn't have to be blatantly occultish. You know what the doctrine of demons was that Paul referred to when he used that term? It was legalism. It was people coming into the early church where people had been taught the doctrine of salvation by grace through faith, and false teachers were coming in and adding something to the gospel. That's what God called doctrine of demons. My point is it can be subtle. Well, it's also important to make distinctions between Moses and Aaron and Pharaoh and his sorcerers. Let's start with this one. Moses and Aaron are not magicians. They're not depending on secret arts and spells to accomplish what they do. The first sign, and I'll add to this, all the subsequent plagues are real. They're not tricks. When Aaron cast down his staff, there's no indication that he said anything. Moses says, "Cast down your staff." He cast down his staff, and he waits for God to perform the miracle of the sign. We're not told this, but I would not be surprised if the counterfeit miracle that Pharaoh's sorcerers did were not accompanied by all sorts of cultic chants and venerated objects. It would have been a real performance. And it probably looked like the miracle was done by the sorcerer, because he did things. But when the transformation of Aaron's staff took place, it would have been clear to everyone that the miracle was done by Yahweh and Yahweh alone, and not by Moses and not by Aaron. No chanting, no secret enchantments, no charms, no spells. We just have obedience. And speaking of obedience, one might conclude from the arrogance of Pharaoh that he didn't learn the lesson because his heart was hardened. Actually, he learned all the lessons. He just learned them too late. Let's not make the same mistake he made.